This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 2012 Olympic Games kick off in London tomorrow. Before the Games begin, we thought we'd take this opportunity to honor a North Carolinian whose work has had a lasting impact on the Olympics. Leroy T. Walker made the headlines as the first African-American president of the U.S. Olympic Committee 20 years ago. His leadership over the 1996 Games in Atlanta, Georgia, is legendary. Walker was 78 years old when he became president of the USOC. He famously gave up a six-figure salary to accept an unpaid position as president. But Leroy Walker's role in the 1996 Olympic Games was the pinnacle of a pioneer's life, one spent struggling against racial segregation, grooming championship athletes, and leading his beloved North Carolina Central University to many, many victories. Leroy Walker passed away in April. He was 93. Today, we're going to recognize his legacy on the Olympic Games and in North Carolina. And here to help us pay tribute are a group of people who knew him very well. With us in the studio is Leroy Walker Jr., known as Kush to the family and friends. Thanks for being with us, Kush.
My pleasure.
Also with us from a studio on the campus of James Madison University in Virginia is Tony Britt. Tony worked closely with Leroy Walker during the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. Hello, Tony.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tony, you know, with all the excitement, the Olympic Games in the air, thinking about London coming up, I want to start with Leroy Walker's leadership during the 1996 Atlantic Games. How was he selected to be what turned out to be the first black president of the U.S. Olympic Committee?
Well, that would have been by a vote of U.S. Olympic Committee organizational members that include the national governing bodies for sports from archery to wrestling and everyone in between, as well as specifically the U.S. Olympic Committee Executive Committee, a group of 7 to 10 officers, again, representing all of our nation's amateur sporting and athletic organizations.
Obviously, he was pretty well known to the amateur athletic world by that time.
Not just well known, but well respected. He had had his hands in so many things and performed in such an excellent manner that it was hard to deny. Here was a man who had achieved great things, overcoming seemingly insurmountable obstacles to rise to the top of his profession. As he would tell you, it was a story that even Hollywood couldn't believe as being unbelievable.
Tell us what the U.S. Olympic Committee president does. I mean, what are they responsible for?
Only making sure that the event goes on with as little problem as possible and that everyone involved is satisfied, joyous about it, that problems that arise every day never become aware of in the public eye. And unfortunately, we had a lot of obstacles to deal with, from the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding event with Lillehammer for the Winter Games, and then the bombing at the Atlanta Summer Games. So there was lots of communication, lots of scheduling, lots of daily events to keep tabs on. Basically, you're wearing a firefighter's hat, putting out fires nonstop.
Can't imagine it. All those countries, all of the attention, and not a lot of room for error. Kush, at the time, now, your father was working as director of sports for the Atlanta Olympic Committee, the Olympic Games Committee. He had a six-figure salary, and he gave that up to be president with no compensation. That's a volunteer job, given all the responsibility. Did he ever explain that decision to you?
Well, I think it's a natural thing that my dad cared so much for the sport that he wanted to do what was right as far as the sport was concerned, and it didn't matter how it affected him. He was concerned that the games and the administration of the games came off without a hitch, and my dad had some unbelievable administrative skills, and he wanted to bring those to bear.
Did he have a personal mission? I know this is with regard to Atlanta itself and those particular games in 96.
I think that might have been at the back of his mind, but the well-being of the name of the Olympic Games, I think, was foremost in his mind. And he wanted to do whatever he could to make sure that Atlanta saw the best.
Tony, you were Leroy's assistant during the time he was USOC president. What was he like as a leader?
Visionary. It was exciting for me to be a part of his plan, because having grown up in Durham, his adopted hometown, he was a sports hero to me. And to follow along a 78-year-old man at the pace he kept was challenging, to say the least.
A leader, an administrator, an organizer, and a promoter, he had quite a reputation as a guy who could really promote sport and get a lot of interested, get people deeply interested in what he was doing. Is that right?
Well, it was while he was in Durham early, when I was just a child, that he and Coach Buehler brought the USA versus Africa and USA versus USSR track and field meets to historic Wallace Wade Stadium at Duke, where I had my first exposure to other cultures right there on our patch of grass in our hometown. It was a thrill to see the Russian athletes there because we had no other exposure to this at all. And in North Carolina, ACC basketball was and still is a religion. But what Dr. Walker accomplished transcended that. I mean, he was not just nationwide, he was international.
And Kush, let's talk about your father's journey to becoming the first black president of the U.S. Olympic Committee. Let's listen, because he describes that in an interview that was filmed by Eagle Video Productions.
I was born in Atlanta on Parsons Street. I've gone from Parsons Street to those 2 miles to the Olympic Stadium. That's been a long 2 miles. When it actually happened and I started down the ramp and I looked up at the flag and I heard the noise, I thought about my mother and how proud she would have been of her son. And I said, now, isn't this a wonderful country? Whatever other problems we may have, that a guy who was born sort of on the other side of the track could come back and be the leading person with the host nation.
That was Leroy Walker in 1996. We're celebrating his life today. His son Kush is with us at the moment. Tony Britt is here with us as well. Kush, what did your father tell you about growing up in Atlanta?
Well, you know, my dad didn't dwell on it a lot. And he always looked towards the future. And as far as my sister and I were concerned, his words were always words of, look, prepare yourself. And whatever you do, do the best you can. So he never dwelled on his upbringing in Atlanta. I did go back often to visit with my grandmother and my aunts and uncles down in Atlanta. But I didn't find out until I was an adult, an older adult, as a matter of fact, some of the things that he endured when he grew up as a child.
Yeah, this would have been Jim Crow in Atlanta, Georgia. Yep. That he would have endured. What about as he became well known? Did he feel the weight and the pressure of somebody who was, having to? He was a symbol, and he was a symbol for his race, whether he liked it or not.
You never would have known it. Mm-hmm. My dad was the calm in the eye of the storm. It was amazing to me how he could handle situations of adversity. And not even blink. I did talk to him about the Tonya Harding situation, and yeah, I asked him what was going through his mind as he handled the situation. And the thing that he said was that there was the time that we had to soothe a lot of feelings. We had to mend some broken fences and make sure that everyone was treated fairly. And as he explained that to me, he was just as calm as he could be. Mm. I never saw him rattled.
Well, Tony, how about you now? You were working with him side by side, and let's take that event in particular. What was his first reaction, and how did he set the priorities for managing that situation?
He was so good at looking forward and knowing what was important and keeping that in mind. I remember how he explained dealing with another situation when Olympic diver Greg Louganis dove and bashed his head on the diving board or the platform. And at the time, we were aware that he had tested HIV positive. So a little blood fell into the pool where Louganis dived. And Dr. Walker's position was, hey, we're talking about a few drops of blood in a pool with hundreds of thousands of gallons of chlorinated water. He could decide what was important and not let hype or hysteria bother him and distract him from his focus.
Did he ever talk with you about his experiences? I mean, there he is in Atlanta, his native city, a city where he did endure certainly a great amount of discrimination growing up. Did he ever talk to you about that, Tony?
Only when I'd pry him, because he is an African-American, so I knew by how I was raised that he had overcome myriad obstacles and hardships to achieve his success, which was so admirable and motivating to me. One of the stories I remember the most was how he would take a station wagon to the Midwest part of the country to recruit football players and promise mothers that he would take care of them back at North Carolina College, which is now, of course, North Carolina Central University, where Dr. Walker became a track coach and then eventually the chancellor of the school. I also know that I went to play golf with him in Denver once, and we were in a pro shop. And I watched the older white gentleman behind the counter take care of everybody else except Dr. Walker. And it slapped me in the face. I was discouraged by it, but Dr. Walker just shook his head and said, "We don't let that bother us. We keep moving forward."
On the State of Things today, we are honoring Leroy T. Walker, first African-American president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, beloved member of the Durham community. He passed away in April at the age of 93. My guests are Leroy Walker Jr. and Tony Britt, who was Leroy Sr.'s assistant during the 1996 Olympic Games. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, before Leroy Walker served as USOC president, he broke down racial barriers as a track and field coach here in Durham, North Carolina. Just ahead, more people who knew Leroy Walker join our conversation as we pay tribute to him on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, we're honoring North Carolina Central University Chancellor Emeritus Leroy T. Walker. He passed away earlier this year at the age of 93. His legacy includes being the first African-American coach to the U.S. Olympic track team and the first black president of the U.S. Olympic Committee. In 1945, Leroy Walker founded the track and field program at North Carolina Central University in Durham. He went on to coach world-class athletes. He formed a special bond with another local coach named Al Buehler of Duke University's track team. Al Buehler, who is another legend, is with us in the studio today to remember his friend and colleague. Al, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also joining us is former Olympian Norman Tate, who was a member of the North Carolina Central track team under Leroy Walker. Norman is now coach and physical education instructor at New Jersey, where he joins us by phone. Hello.
Hello.
And Leroy's son, Leroy Cush Walker Jr., is also with us. Norman, let me ask you, North Carolina Central University, of course, North Carolina College at Durham, when you arrived in the early 1960s, you attended on a track scholarship, although Coach Leroy Walker never saw you run. How'd that come to pass?
When I finished high school, I was injured my senior year, didn't compete in the state meet, and so schools that had been recruiting me, you know, at that time, basically dropped off the map. And I was working, in Jersey at the time in a store, and the track coach from Plainfield High School, who was one of our rivals, was a good friend of Dr. Walker's, and he saw me working in the store and wanted to know why wasn't I in college. And, I told him, the whole story. So he contacted Dr. Walker. And then Dr. Walker called me on the telephone and asked me, would I like to, come to North Carolina College? And I said yes. And so basically he recruited me over the telephone without ever seeing me, physique, talent, or whatever. He went on the word of a good friend of his. And I guess the rest became history after I arrived.
It turned out to be a good find on his part. What was Dr. Walker like as a coach?
Well, as a coach, I say this to this day, he's the best coach that I ever had as an athlete. Even after I left North Carolina, Dr. Walker was still my coach. I competed up until 1972 to the Olympic Trials in 72 in Eugene, and I didn't make the team. I got hurt at the trials, but from 1961 when I went to North Carolina until, you know, I finished competing. Dr. Walker was always my coach, you know, via the telephone or, you know, in person. Several teams that I competed on, national teams, Dr. Walker was the coach. So he was always my coach as an athlete.
Even because you did compete in 68 in Mexico.
Yes.
And even there, you were he was your coach.
Coach, yes.
Wow.
He was, as I said, yeah, I mean, he was the one and only coach that I ever had.
Well, you know, he was, well, you were from New Jersey, as you said. You're back there now. And, of course, you're coming to the South in 1960. What was that like for you? What was the racial climate here? And how big, what, was it a shock for you?
Well, it was very different. You know, 1961 in Durham was very different. You know, segregation was prevalent, and but it wasn't a shock because my relatives were from North Carolina originally. So I used to go to North Carolina as a kid to family reunions and stuff. So I was aware of, you know, the segregation that was present at that time. So it wasn't a shock. So the adjustment to the climate wasn't, you know, that you know, much. It wasn't overwhelming for me. The thing that I remember most about coming to North Carolina then, I was a very passive type individual, and I think that was the first thing that Dr. Walker started to bring out of me, was that in order to be the best athlete that I could be, I had to you know, look at things from a, you know, different viewpoint. I had to learn to be that aggressive individual to want to be the best, to want to work hard. I think I took my talent for granted, you know, initially. And Dr. Walker used to tell me, you know, he would, you know, little sayings. Coach had these sayings, you know, like, you know, if you kill a fly, hit him with a hammer. You know, don't let him come back to bite you. You know, those little sayings that he would, you know, just throw out, and to help bring about, you know, that aggressiveness that you needed to be as a competitor. You know, when I the thing that I think that I wasn't used to when I first came there was the conditions of the facility itself when it came to the track. And I remember, you know, the first time I saw our track, you know, there was grass growing up in it, and basically it was dirt. And Dr. Walker told me, he said, well, you know, don't worry about the conditions. You can, you know, be the best regardless of what kind of surface you train on. But at that time, that's when we started going to Duke, and that's when I met Coach Buehler. And, you know, the one thing that the thing that I remember most about going into Wallace Wade Stadium that first time was we were treated as though we were students at Duke by Coach Buehler, by the athletic staff there. I'll never forget their trainer, Max. They always treated me like I was a student and that I was a member of Duke's track team.
Well, Carl, let me check with, because Coach Buehler is here, and I want to ask you, Coach, how that came about, how it came to be that you and Dr. Walker got together and you offered the facility, Duke's facilities, to...
Well, it started with the 56 games in Mexico City, which were high altitude, but we had three very fine athletes at that time. Who one was Dave Sim, the sprinter, who was setting world records. They had Lee Calhoun, who was a world-class hurdler, and then we had Joel Shankle, another hurdler. So really it was the two coaches saying, if we train at Duke with on good facilities, we can take these guys to the highest level. And they actually were enough difference in personalities and talents and so forth, but they were all in sprints and hurdles, you see, which was Leroy's forte. He loved that because his degree at Columbia was physiology of exercise. So we just invited them over because there was no way they could have made the Olympic team training on what Central had at the point. And that's not a put-down. That's just, you know, where you play, you can.
Yeah, no, it makes a difference. But what made you decide? I mean, that was not a time. I mean, Duke was completely closed to African American students.
Well, yes, they were not integrated. But see, Bob Chambers was the head track coach. I was the assistant coach in cross country, and then all that changed because in '72 we were integrated. But Leroy and I quietly just they came over and we were able to work out and. Calhoun and
Dave
Sim didn't make it because he got injured. So that was one of the time if you couldn't take part in the trials, you were not just put on the team. But Joel Shankle got third, so they were 1-3 in the world, the hurdles, you see. And that was because we could work them together. Dave Sim was by far the fastest, but the others weren't you know, they weren't pluggers, you know, they were good too, but they were also going over hurdles. So when you put them together, they each helped the other one out. Shankle was more of a decathlete type guy, so he was, you know, strong and everything.
But you're talking about students from Central and from Duke essentially competing against each other and making each other better.
Yes, they were working together because I took the distance runners and we worked that way. And we combined our teams and called them Duke Central. In the AA era, in the summertime, see, that's because after college track and field was finished, there was no place for them. So we put together a AAU team, see, which was represented by the Olympics, see, Olympic Committee, IOC, that Leroy got involved with. They had seven sports that they controlled, boxing and wrestling and track and field and a whole bunch of them. Riflery and things that, you know. Right.
So what's the reaction on campus, though? You guys might think it's a great idea and get this thing done, but you're having to show up on campus.
Well, you know, Wade Stadium is, you know, off in the corner, but we weren't trying to hide anything. People would come down, they just saw people practicing track. And there wasn't any difference, you see. I would say that no one in the administration thought that anything was going on that shouldn't have taken place. See, it was something that because we were buddies and friends in track, that the whole thing went smoothly, you see.
Cush, what did your father say about this relationship? Because these two were very good friends. That's what comes across pretty clearly. It's not just that this was a good idea. This wasn't a political statement. These guys liked each other.
Yep, and that's how I knew Coach Buehler. He was a friend of my dad's, and they were in the same sport. So it seemed very natural that they had the relationship that they did. And my dad never made a big deal out of it. He just said that Coach Buehler and I are going to do so-and-so and so-and-so. And I said, okay, you guys are friends, you're buddies, you're in the same sport. And that was the way it was.
And the athletes, too. We named some of those key athletes. They were certainly
together. I mean, they actually, you know, were so close in talent and all they needed was good facilities to allow all of them to make maximum of their talents, you see.
We are honoring the legendary coach and educator Leroy Walker on today's show. And I want to talk about Leroy Walker's coaching style. And for that, I'm going to introduce Ed Lovelace. He's the athletic trainer and athletic trainer, I should say. He's also based in New Jersey. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Hello there. Hello there.
What was it like to train under Dr. Walker?
It was a shock and a exhilarating experience. It was kind of a utopia because my introduction to track and field was with Coach Tate. He was my coach, again, like Dr. Walker was for him. He was my coach from the very beginning and until I stopped running and turned it into business. So all the teachings and the stories that Coach Tate would teach, I mean, I started running with Coach in eighth grade. And, you know, he guided me through many different things, even beyond track and field. And I turned out to do really, really well out of New York and went on to Arizona State University per the tutelage of Coach Tate. And, you know, Arizona State went through a little rocky time, and they let some of the coaching staff go and appoint Dr. Walker as our coach. And it was euphoric because here's a man that I met every now and then at Milrose, sitting high atop of the perch, and now he was my coach in college. It was like a dream come true because every day at track practice in high school, Coach Tate would tell us a story about the hill or doing repeat 200s or running poles, and here I was, like, living writing this storybook on training, and then going on the road with Dr. Walker and having him share all his like wealth of information, which even further validated what Coach Tate would share with us. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It's great to hear from a great teacher, but then when you see his mentor, it really does something for you. Well, how much of the style and how much of his coaching talent was psychological, getting you to believe in yourself, and how much of it was physiological, the mechanics of your sport?
I remember Dr. Walker saying, I mean, Coach Tate, I was much like Tate early. I was passive, I was quiet, and I never forget one summer, I was running and I was sitting there all quiet in the corner, and Coach Tate, we just call him Tate. We wouldn't say Coach Tate. Tate would say, "Hey man, get aggressive," and that stuck with me. It really stuck that day. And now hearing Coach saying, Dr. Walker told him the same thing, it was pretty cool, because Dr. Walker then in Arizona State, he said it's all, you know, it's 90% mental and 10% physical. He kept saying that to us. And that came with the hard workouts, running in the 100-degree heat. So it was the exact same thing, and just made you stick your chest out even further and become that much more aggressive, because the story never changed, you know?
Coach Buehler, you and Dr. Walker organized a couple of huge events here in the 1970s. The Pan-African U.S. Games, and then after that, the Games with the USSR. First of all, tell us about that Pan-African team and how that idea came about.
Well, as I remember, we started with the Martin Luther King Games that had been held in Philadelphia, and they had money problems. So we invited them to come down if they wanted to get on a good track, and that meet was where largely the black athletes, but others were invited. So when they came to Duke, we had just a good mix of people who were probably all going to make the Olympic team, or at least be in that level. And I was going to say that wasn't a big deal. We were just had a facility and was available in the summertime, you see. And it was a chance for Durham. We had this member of the Merchants Association gave us, I think, $30,000. You could run a track meet on $30,000 because there weren't any agents involved. Mm. All you had to do was pay room and board and get them down there, and they were glad to run, you see. So the timing was right. Everything was open because we were doing it, you know, for Durham. This was Durham's chance to show off what they could do. And then as I think back, we had such quality, and because it was part of the AAU, Title IX wasn't in, so there weren't many women in track and field in college, you see, but they were in the AAU, and that's where the high school coach, what was his name, Dr., you know, over there. Okay, he'll come up with the name, but high school, Hillside High School.
Russell Blunt.
He was my age now, or in that time, but he was football, basketball, and track and field. So we had...
These were big events, too, these events that we're talking about, and they certainly made, you know, they were on Wide World of Sports and all the national TV, and they made a big deal of these. But how were your coaching styles or your administrative styles complimentary, would you say, Al, you and Dr.
Well,
Walker?
See, Duke had been hosting fairly good sized meet, like the Duke Durham Relays used to have 5,000 kids come in. Just you had to show them where their exchange zones were. They were uninitiated, and I had a good core of officials. See, you need somewhere around 120, 150 guys to run off a 2-day meet, you see, right, to measure everything and time everything and select everything.
Right.
Just people to bring their sweat gear back. And you can't start a race unless you have in 8 lanes, you got to have 8 starting blocks there.
That was your skill, right? I mean, you had that. You had all the details
down. That's what I was. That was my...
You were the detail guy. And then Dr. Walker, what was his role? Because
Well, he enjoyed promoting and looking ahead. And what I was going to say, Cush, correct me, wasn't he on the Peace Corps thing through Africa? And that's where he made all the contacts for the Pan-African. He said, "You guys can't even have a meet in Africa, but if you'll come to Durham and run under one flag, we'd love to have you."
And that was the first time that the different countries in Africa competed under one flag in an athletic event.
Right. So it was an amazing spectacle for Americans to see this whole thing.
Especially Durham, North Carolina.
North Carolina. You know. Yeah. So let me ask you, Kush, because you're with, given all of your father's accomplishments and his long, long career, did he ever slow down? Did he enjoy his accomplishments? How did he take all of this?
He took it all in stride. And did he slow down? No, he didn't. Up until a couple of years ago, we had a tradition, not a couple of years ago, a couple of months before he passed, we had a tradition of going to lunch with some of his former athletes and sport associates. And we did that every other Wednesday. And it was something that he always looked forward to. And even at 92, almost 93, he always wanted to be on the go. His words to me, whenever I was taking him back to his place from anywhere we were, his words were, "Well, what's on the agenda for tomorrow?"
He has left us a great legacy. We thank you so much for being on the program.
Our pleasure.
Helping us pay tribute to Leroy T. Walker were his son, Leroy Walker Jr., known as Kush. Al Buehler is chairman of the Health, Physical Education, and Recreation Department at Duke, where he has coached track for 45 years. He's the subject of a new book and a documentary, both titled Starting at the Finish Line, available at CoachBuehler.com. Norman Tate and Ed Lovelace are athletic trainers in New Jersey. For more information on their coaching program, visit TheFew.com. Few is spelled P-H-E-W. More of the State of Things is ahead. Stay with us.